Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by curator and film historian Alicia Fletcher and film and culture writer Rad Simon Pillay. On the list of actors who have fascinating career trajectories, there are very few more talked about than Nick Cage. We got into his early career a bit in our season 2 episode about The Boy in Blue and his inexplicably anachronistic performance. This, of course, was 80s Nicolas Cage, before he would become the high drama darling of the early 90s award scene, and of course, before he would become the intensely memeable action star of the late 90s. Today, we're going to look at two movies from 97, which Alicia gloriously refers to as full action kabuki. But before we do that, let's have a look at where Mr. Cage was in his careening career trajectory. Alicia, I know you are an enormous fan, but I'm still trying to understand why.
Really? Even in 2021, we can't just admit that he's the greatest?
Yeah.
I mean, I've been asked by press why I'm such a fan of Nicolas Cage. I never have a very good canned response, except if you look at his filmography, it has a little bit of everything. And I love I love that kabukiness. And I think we're seeing that kind of for one of the first times in 1997 with both of these films. Certainly Face Off more than Con Air. But looking at him at this, and keep in mind, Face Off and Con Air are released within 3 weeks of each other in the summer of 1997. Both of them are sharing like the top five box office. There was no bigger year for Nicolas Cage than 1997. Arguably, perhaps the year prior, where he starred in, 2 years prior, where he starred in Leaving Las Vegas, was a real turning point for him, because he would have won the Academy Award in early 96 for that, which, you know, he had been nominated prior, like for Moonstruck. So he was sort of an awards darling. And I think after 1997, when he's been in these, insane films, and certainly The Rock with Face Off and Con Air are kind of considered the holy trinity of Nicolas Cage action, his career would really take a turn and kind of lands more in the place that we think of him today. And I'm always fascinated by his choices that he makes currently. The first film I saw back out in the theater from the pandemic was Pig, and that's a whole, we don't need to talk a lot about that, but I loved Pig so much. And if you look at the filmography, there's always usually two films a year that he does. 97, it's just these two, Face Off and Con Air. But, looking at 95, you have like Kiss of Death, which is a ridiculous action film where he plays little Junior Brown. And then you have Leaving Las Vegas. And then in like 94, you have It Could Happen to You and Guarding Tess. Like, he always has these kind of bookendy films, two per year, that contradict each other. And I think it's really interesting in 97 because we get two films, Con Air and Face Off, that complement each other so, so well. So much so that they can be in the same megaplex at the same time in the universe. I mean, imagine being alive in June or July, is July, I think, of 1997, where you could like pay for Con Air and then sneak into Face Off or vice versa. Like, that is...
I actually snuck into both of these movies because I was 12 years old and these were PG-13.
Yes.
And I was very important to the boy that I was very enamored with that we go to see these movies. So we snuck in together.
Are you sure they can't
be?
PG-13?
They were PG-13.
They were R.
No, Face Off was R. It might be PG-13 now, but I thought it was... I was convinced it was R in 97.
Well, I mean, so being in Canada, because I was 15 at the time, and I remember that I'm pretty sure they were 14A, right? Because we had a lot of the R-rated movies or PG-13 movies would fall into 14A, and that was our situation. I don't know if that's
probably. I just remember I snuck into it, and we almost got called out on it by this like teenager who came in and was like, "Should you be in this movie?" And we were like, "Why, yes, we should." And like, look at how adult we are.
Oh. And just a clarification, back then, I don't think it was actually called 14A back then. I think it was actually Adult
Accommodation. Yeah. Regardless, these were movies I probably should not have seen at that age.
I would always joke that I was going to, you know, go to my AA meeting, which is not a very good joke, but it was like exciting. How I would have been, your age exactly, Becky. It would have been exciting to go see an AA film at 12 because you weren't technically supposed to. And all of John Woo's films prior, well, maybe not Broken Arrow, but like anything, John Woo was very much a rated R director. Now, Con Air is strange because it's produced by Disney, which is like, and is currently on Disney Plus without any disclaimers. And rewatching it for this podcast, well, I mean, I watch this film once a year, but rewatching it in this context, I was like, oh, it needs several disclaimers. And I love that kids can just access Con Air when they like put the word C in trying to find Cinderella. And it's like, oh, I could watch Con Air. Like Cinderella, Con Air.
That's what the parental advisory button is for. And then the pins on everything else. Let me tell you, it is something we've done, especially now that all the Alien movies are available there. Because, yeah, it's we love Amphibia. We don't need to watch Alien at 7. It's not happening. Yeah.
Well, I guess Con Air is a Cinderella story. Nick Cage has his long hair. He's on a pumpkin. He's got to be back at a certain
bunny.
Time.
There's a
magical bunny. Oh, God. Yeah, okay, I'm taking us into the first movie. Here we go. Because aside from the bees meme, is there a more memeable moment than the long-haired tank top Cage stepping into the fresh air and whipping his luxurious mane around as he takes in the sunshine? And this, of course, is only one of the wildest moments in the increasingly nonsensical cavalcade of chaos that is Con Air. It just keeps like escalating. And the plot is kind of simple on this one. Rad, do you want to take a stab at it?
Yeah, I mean, I think like just first off, just bouncing off your that shot you refer the shot you're referencing, which is, you know, it was on all the trailers. It's Nicolas Cage stepping off a plane and yes, flocking that mane, looking very Fabio like. I think that was the first indication that the plot does not matter. Nothing matters. This is all nonsense because that look does not fit Nicolas Cage at all. Okay, like that, like
if
that
he was
him like
have
like,
that look. It would have been in Raising Arizona. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But it's like, I mean, that was like a Jean-Claude Van Damme look. Like Van Damme pulled that off in maybe like the early 90s and stuff, but it wasn't working for Nicolas Cage. Like, you know, he doesn't have the kind of muscles to pull off the whole I'm gonna walk around a tank top for the whole movie, even though he tried. I don't know, Alicia might be disagreeing with me here, but
no, I think he looks, this is like him in peak physical shape, I would say.
Which is still not good enough to pull off the tank top. The look, okay?
Yeah, he's a wiry man as opposed to being like a big bulky superhero. Exactly. He's, you know, slender, trim, yes.
So like, you know, it didn't make sense, and neither does the plot of Con Air, which is about a bunch of, you know, it's a jailbreak movie where the jail is in the air, okay? Like it is about a prison transport where this giant cargo jet is transferring the world's most vicious criminals, and it just so happens that this Marine who is serving time for a murder he shouldn't be serving time for, where, you know, a murder that was committed in self-defense, he just so happens to be hitching a ride on this extremely maximum security prison in the air. He's hitching a ride back home to his family, who's waiting on him. And of course, when there is a jailbreak, a hostage taking, he is in the middle of it like John McClane in Die Hard, and he's got to foil the whole thing while pretending to the criminals that he is still one of them.
That was well done.
That's perfect. That was actually really good. Okay. Yes. Yeah. And it's like, as they're introducing all these people, let's say also that the plane stops multiple times to pick up more character actors who never actually get the due. Like, there's so many characters here that I would actually really want to follow who they are. Like, I am fascinated with Sally Can't Dance. Mm-hmm. How did she get there? Why is she so vicious? Like, I want to know way more about her. Steve Buscemi's character deserves a whole film. Right. Like, it's just, I feel a little robbed while simultaneously being like, I'm at a buffet and I can't eat any more MSG.
I could have done less with Danny Trejo, despite the fact that I love Danny Trejo. And I think this was a real turning point in his career. He plays Johnny 23 because he was convicted of raping 23 women. And there is a female guard named Bishop in this film. And the whole, like, I really would like to delete that plot of, like, you know, she's going to get attacked because he wants to become Johnny 24. And I'm like, why are we celebrating this? This is a little
disturbing. Well, and that's the only reason why there is a female guard, is for that plot line to happen, which is blah. It is, however, Rachel Ticotin from Total Recall,
she's
who
great.
Is the ultimate woman, as we all know. She's fabulous. Yeah.
The turning point in Danny Trejo's career, because, I mean, it was just a year or two ago that he was in Desperado? Because that's how we discovered
Desperado's 94, right? So this would be maybe his first, like...
I think it's 95. And also Heat was the same year,
this would be his big turn in, like, $100 million, like... Disney film. Right. You know, it's Danny Trejo, friend of the Muppets, first Disney film as a rapist. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, I disagree that I would want more from Steve Buscemi's character, who is this, like, Hannibal Lecter-ish person, like, tossed into the plane in an ultimate wheelchair that, like, keeps him hemmed in and stuff. Because it's like, I guess the best thing about that character is that we know absolutely nothing, and we don't know what to make of him when he's in one fight. When, like, it's like, this is a character who apparently
32 people
murdered.
He was, like, known as the Marietta Mangler.
Right, yeah, exactly. And so, like, I mean, as wrong as so much of this is, like, getting to that scene where he's playing dollhouse with the little girl and the tension and dread of that moment, which still leaves me uncomfortable, but at the same time,
yes,
riveted.
Absolutely.
I think the least we know about his character is the better. But the thing is, I mean, we're talking about the entrances, right? I think the entrances is what makes Con Air.
Yeah.
Even if it's as ludicrous as Nicolas Cage, doing the thing with his mane, but it's like, it's everyone's entrance, like Ving Rhames' entrance when he hops off and he's all
Diamond
hip-hop,
Dog,
like,
yeah.
he looks like he's like Suge Knight basically coming off a bus at that time, right? I think this is we're at the stage where Death Row was just about falling apart, so there's a real, like, seeing Ving Rhames in this red, orange, brightly colored doing that prance off the thing. It's like all of these villains are channeling us a very different energy, right down, like, first of all, my favorite thing about this movie is John Malkovich as Cyrus the Virus. It's an incredible performance. But even Dave Chappelle,
he's great, not a, in this, and he's improvising.
Yeah, but like, I mean, like, I and he's absolutely hilarious. So there's a real diverse mix of fascinating characters that elevate this movie that is otherwise pretty ridiculous.
It's complete ridiculousness, and I think you're totally right, Rad, that it throws everything at the wall, and while not everything sticks, what does stick is very delicious. And you know, it the idea of, you have Colm Meaney in this film, and he's just yelling the whole film. He serves no purpose other than to get his, like, penis car basically destroyed and just scream the whole time.
Your men are incompetent! They let themselves get taken over by a bunch of thugs and chains and cages!
But Dave Chappelle is quite good in this, and obviously quite a contentious figure right now. But if you want to see his body hurled out of an airplane and land on a Volvo, this is the film for you, if that's cathartic.
That is probably the most memorable sight gag I remember from a movie ever, right? Like,
this is a movie where there's so many things that have happened in it, and there's so many, like, this is happening, and they're just throwing everything at you, that you forget that there is a fire truck chase at the end.
Oh, yeah.
You forget
the motorcycles,
like,
all that I forgot, even though I watched this once a year. I was watching it this morning, and I was like, okay, the film seems like it's over. And I was like, wait a minute, it's 35 minutes. It's like...
Right. But the motorcycle, I mean, is that like a reshoot?
It has to be.
The motorcycle, it feels like such a reshoot. Like, the movie seemed like over, then they forgot, oh, we didn't kill the bad guy. Yeah. Like, we didn't see him die. We need to do a thing.
Here's a theory I have. So I recently went back and watched Terminator 2, and I realized what is so amazing about Terminator 2 is also, yes, the special effects are still great, but that is a movie that has multiple climaxes. Like, oh, you think it's over? Nope, this is happening. Oh, you think it's over? Nope, this is now happening. Now he's doing this. And if you watch, that's the turning point for action movies doing that. They didn't do that before. And I think they're doing a Terminator 2 thing. We're like, oh, you think it's over? Nope, here's the next thing. And they just keep raising the stakes until someone's head gets crushed.
I think for Bruckheimer, like, The Rock has that to some extent as well, which is just the year prior. So, like, this is just where we are. We just can't end films. They all have to be about 2 hours or longer. You know, luckily we're not in the 2021 era where films are literally 2 hours and 45 minutes and then you sit through trailers, but like 2 hours is a long running time when you think about a special effects budget for a film like Con Air and to a lesser extent Face Off. I'm thoroughly entertained. I think this is a smorgasbord film. Definitely it's in the canon of smorgasbords. I think Cyrus the Virus, which is John Malkovich's character, that is such an important piece of the puzzle, because if that had not been effective, this film would have failed completely. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting looking at who they thought they were going to get to play him. Originally, it was going to be Gary Oldman, who, of course, was in his own, like, insane, chaotic airplane film in 1997, Air Force One. And I know Malkovich, interestingly enough, refuses to discuss this role. Like, if you go into, I don't know if you've ever interviewed Malkovich Rad, but he don't bring up Con Air. It goes very badly. This is on his like blacklist of films, which I think is kind of sad because it's at least seems like he's having fun.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is, he is such an incredible character, but that's probably based on his own experience of it, right? Like, if you try to talk to Matt Damon about some of the about Bourne Ultimatum, he goes real sour, right? It's not like Bourne Ultimatum, but it's because of his experience with Tony Gilroy.
What I have heard about this one and also about our next one is these were not particularly safe sets. And a lot of people were put in situations where they should not have been put.
Somebody was killed on Con Air, right? Which is very, I mean, you think about, like, especially now we're talking about what happened on the Rust set. Right?
This was specifically a special effects supervisor named Phil Schwartz, who was underneath one of the model, like very large scale model airplanes, and it it fell and crushed him. And so the film is dedicated to his name. And that was something that actually I was not aware of until doing research for this, that, you know, I think in 2021, that would be a much bigger news story. But if you look at the 90s, there's a lot of special effects people and actors for that matter who are killed making films, and we kind of the news just kind of passes it by.
It's also the big switchover transition between practical and CGI. Like, this has a bunch of practical effects that now would entirely be digital and therefore would be much safer. We're going to talk about that in the second one too, but that's just John Woo's thing. He likes to, you know, throw things at other things and see what explodes.
But I do want to, like, I do want to go back to like the Nicolas Cage career arc thing, right? Because I think in terms of, well, I mean, not just Nicolas Cage, because I think, like, experiencing, like, because when we saw him in action movie mode in The Rock, right, like, that made sense, because it's like he is this gangly, nerdy looking dorkish character, and his character in The Rock made sense because he was like, it's like, this guy shouldn't be in an action movie, and he knew it. Right? Like, he's like,
and he's not Kabuki.
He's not Kabuki
in The Rock. He's not, he's very caged. He's not uncaged. It's 1997 where the cage door opens and he bursts onto the scene.
But that's what The Rock is like, his gateway drug, right? It's like, it's the movie that, like, then all of a sudden positioned him to then go full again, coming out and tossing his mane and stuff. Like, so that's such a weird transition to go from this, like, you know, like this movie where he's like testing the waters of an action movie and then coming out off a bus and flocking his mane.
I think he was given a lot of leeway. Like, he's got an Academy Award under his belt. The Rock was ginormous at the box office, which proved that he could carry an action film. And I feel like with Jerry Bruckheimer on Con Air especially, they were like, you do whatever you want. You play this character however you want. The accent is ludicrous. And I'm okay with that. Like, I expect that. The amount of times he says things like, put the bunny back in the bag, or like weird, just bad dialogue.
He's so proud of that bunny.
Well, it's all he has, Becky, because he's been in prison and it's expensive to buy things in prison.
I said, put the bunny back in the box.
But he's just really given full tilt and he takes it. And that's why for 97, that's the origin of Uncaged Cage. Even though we have Uncaged Cage in Moonstruck, and we have Uncaged Cage in Zandali and all these films I'm obsessed with. Those were all kind of, well, Moonstruck's a huge film, but like something like Zandali is a smaller film. This is where we get someone in a $100 million film that would become the Kabuki Cage that we know and love today.
But in terms of transitions though, I think Con Air was basically like the end of the Die Hard style action movie, because and I think the part of that transition, and it's kind of the runoff, it is runoff of the Michael Bay era, basically. Like, it's like it's a movie that feels completely like it's like we have to follow this mold that Michael Bay created in his 1-2 punch of Bad Boys and The Rock very much being in the Die Hard style. But then, you know, Michael Bay transitions towards first comes Armageddon, and then we start getting the island, and we get towards Transformers. Yeah. So this disaster, that kind of blockbuster action movie. And Con Air is this kind of this thing in between where it's definitely, you know, it's got Mark Mancina, who was the sound guy for both. He did the music for Bad Boys. It's got like that kind of golden light visual style that Michael Bay loves so much. So it's like it is like kind of the last remnants of that. Like, of that era before Michael Bay turned it into Transformers.
That's a really great point.
We've turned the action movie towards
And this is probably an era where, you know, I wouldn't say in 1997 when I was very young that I loved action films. I grew up on them. I grew up on Jean-Claude Van Damme, but I had never seen a John Woo film, probably, at least certainly not his Asian films. I'd maybe seen the American ones, but like, this was a film that at least, like, even if you weren't into action, appealed to everyone. I would say Con Air. No, I'd say...
Oh, you're still... Okay,
I know, I was saying,
John
like,
Woo,
for both of these, I just had... I wasn't, like, accustomed to either, like, these kind of action films. But, like, in terms of, you know, 1997, Con Air, even though it was probably rated AA in Canada and maybe PG-13 in the US, I think families went and saw this. I think this was, you know, universally appealing. A lot of the reviews from 97 are pretty mean to it because I think they thought it was something that it wasn't. Like, this film knows it's dumb. It knows it's ridiculous, and it embraces that. In the same way that some of the, like, I'd say the adventure films from the 50s do that, or, you know, universal horror films from the 30s. Like, it knows what it is, and when it's good at what it is, it's glorious. And I think that's why we can watch it, you know, 25 years later.
I think this is Cage still shaking off his prestige thing. Like, did he ever actually want that prestige drama darling persona? Like, did he want that? Or is he just happy making the movies that he wants to make that are just, like, fun and weird and he gets to embody different maniacs?
I think he likes variety. And I think, you know, I don't know if any of our listeners or either of you have seen Leaving Las Vegas, but it's a riveting performance.
It's incredible.
That was absolutely deserving of an Academy Award. And again, like that year, he's doing something like, I can't remember what the name of the film is, Deadfall? No, Kiss of Death, which is Barbet Schroeder.
Right.
It's just him like doing push-ups the whole film. I mean, that's released within months of Leaving Las Vegas. So I think, and Deadfall is like 93, which is, sometimes if you like Google like Nicolas Cage most insane moments, most of those moments are from Deadfall where he's wearing the prosthetic nose. Very few people have seen it, but I encourage our listeners to research Deadfall. It was going to be the secret film when we did Uncaged at the review, but then the pandemic shut that whole festival down. I probably shouldn't have revealed that because we still want to do... Anyway, that's for listeners only. I don't think he cared. I think it was about like maintaining integrity, about having fun, about... He's very method. Like, I know when we go to talk about Face Off, there was a lot of things that he was very frustrated by with being on set. Like, he really has to get into character. And there's a lot of, you know, commentary about his real roles today that he just takes all of these films because he has to pay off his, like, you know, bank, his castles and whatever, the bones of Elephant Man or whatever he bought and he's in debt for.
The pyramid in New Orleans, yes.
Yeah, but I think, he won't give up that New Orleans space. That's like his home. But that's a little side note. But I think he does this still to this day because he likes to work and he likes variety. And I think that was true in 1997 and, you know, even 95 when he was doing Leaving Las Vegas.
I want to bring us into John Cusack as well, because this is a weird period for John Cusack. And a lot of people forget he's in this too. And you're like, okay, he's the guy who's making the phone calls from like the control room. And he mostly stands in his giant David Burney-ian suit, which my partner pointed out to me. Arsenio Hall was a very big fashion influence in the 90s. And we all need to remember this. But then he gets on the motorbike and then he becomes an action star in his own right. And you don't often think John Cusack action star. Is he hideously miscast in this, or is this exactly where his career should have gone?
I feel like he was kind of perfectly cast in this, right? He has the look. He's like, you know, that kind of dorky, there's a dorky coolness to him that I think was just right for this, right? Where he's like, he could be an action star, but from a desk. From where he's positioned.
Yeah.
It almost becomes like a buddy cop movie at a certain point.
Kind of.
Yeah. I mean, John Cusack strikes me as the kind of person that just, he has so much curiosity and empathy in his face where it's like, there's something guarded about his kind of disposition, but then there's something empathetic about his eyes, and that's just so kind
he's
of
an everyman. He feels like the boy next door.
Yeah.
We're talking about that buddy cop moment, Becky. Definitely when they get on the police motorcycles together in unison, that's probably where that's at its most peak. But if we're going to talk about like Nicolas Cage trajectory, I mean, look at John Cusack's trajectory recently. Like, if you haven't seen an unhinged John Cusack, I encourage everyone to watch The Paperboy, which is one of the most insane performances. He's kind of gone full Kabuki at this point. Certainly his Edgar Allan Poe film is very odd performance. There's a similarity there. Like, it took longer for him to get there than Cage, but he's very much there right now. I mean, if you look at Cage's example, my assumption is his paycheck for Face Off and Con Air combined, as well as, you know, from the year previous, The Rock, would have been so enormous that he was able to fund his own production company. And by, you know, 99, he is shooting something like Shadow of the Vampire, which is his first produced film. And I absolutely love that film. So I love the idea that Shadow of the Vampire kind of exists because Con Air and Face Off exist. Like, it makes sense to me.
I just want to counter a point you made earlier about this, before this is being like Nicolas Cage's action kind of phase ending here, because I think we're forgetting Gone in 60 Seconds.
And Next and Drive Angry and like.
Yeah. But I mean, Gone in 60 Seconds being like that kind of a peak
and National
action,
Treasure
kind of action mode before going into National Treasure.
No, exactly. It's always been there.
Before going into kids Disney, really breaking open that Disney style of like National Treasure. And I think, did he do Sorcerer's Apprentice?
Yeah. There's Sorcerer's Apprentice. Yeah. And then what's that other medieval one he did with Ron Perlman that I'm actually quite a fan of? I can't remember what it's called, but something Crusade. But action's always going to be there. And I would argue, you know, we're really in a Cage renaissance around, you know, 2020, 2021, going into 2022, like the Lovecraft stuff that he's doing, like The Color Out of Space has action elements of it, but certainly Mandy has a very interesting twist on the action genre. He does it really well. I guess the turning point is that 97 is when he got paid $1 billion to do it.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And Snake Eyes. I mean, Snake Eyes has elements, which is 98. Oh, yeah. This is just right after, you know, like following 97, he makes two films, City of Angels, which we don't need to talk about, and Snake Eyes. And so again, he's still bookending or like having these weird contrarian companion pieces. 99 is a bit different because it's 8mm and Bringing Out the Dead, which are much more thematic to me, like yoked. I think Bringing Out the Dead is one of his greatest performances and a film that I absolutely love. And we have it on Hollywood Suite coming up, which we're really excited about. But I could talk about Nicolas Cage for hours.
Well,
let's hone it in on Face
Off. That's right. Let's move it on to the next one. All right. So when we come back after the break, it's, of course, Face Off. Will they take their face off and scream about it? You bet they will. It's coming up after the break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
There's a debate that has been going on in my household almost since the inception of my partner and I's relationship, and that is, which is the ultimate action movie? Die Hard or Hard Boiled, with myself falling squarely in the Hard Boiled camp. And I love the Rube Goldberg machines of action that John Woo creates, and he's certainly doing a hell of a job in increasing the already absurd action sequences at every turn, so you don't know how bonkers Face Off actually is until you have a moment to breathe when the credits roll. Alicia, let's talk about Face Off. Do you have a favorite set piece here?
I was going to say the carousel, but that's really callous. So it's such an odd opening to a film, and that it kind of is a bookend. I mean, I think my favorite set piece would be the prison sequence where Nicolas Cage's character is wearing the same metallic boots that they used for the Goombas in the Mario Brothers movie, which are like these, it's this like futuristic jail where they can, electromagnetize the boots and the prisoners can't move. And it's utterly ludicrous because, as you pointed out, Becky, a little bit earlier when we were just chatting, It's not made explicit that this film takes place in the future, but it clearly does. But it's not enough in the future where something like those Goomba boots make any sense in a world outside of a video game. So that's definitely one of my favorite set pieces.
It's 2002 out of 1997. And what I love is the idea of like, oh, no one's going to believe this technology exists now. And it's like, yes, because that's the problem I have with this movie's believability.
I mean, is
when the facial technology.
The facial technology apparently exists as of like a couple years ago. They did the first facial transplant rather recently on a gentleman who had accidentally shot his face off. And one of the other set pieces I kind of love is they, you know, in anticipation of doing the facial, you know, surgery, they show how they've reconstructed one of the police officer's ears that got shot off by Nicolas Cage's character. And it's just essentially 3D printing today. Like, I feel like I could go and get the 3D printer at the Toronto Reference Library and potentially manufacture an ear in 2021. So
are you getting the raw materials from?
Well, fair. I mean, it took a little bit longer than what John Woo predicted with that 5-year turnaround, but we're inching closer and closer to the reality of Face Off, which is both it's not exciting, it's terrifying.
Well, I think the believability is less about whether this technology is possible and more about why did we have to go to this length to find out where a bomb is.
Fair. Right?
Like, if we have wiretapping and, you know, any sort of GPS, nope, not happening. Before we get into that, there's a bomb, obviously. People's faces get switched. Alicia, do you want to give us just a quick plot summary on this one? If someone inexplicably has not seen this movie.
Yeah, so Sean Archer is played by John Travolta. He is, I can't remember if he's the FBI or DEA, but he's an enforcer of some kind. And his... Anti-terrorism, yes, thank you, Rad. And his sworn enemy is Castor Troy, played by Nicolas Cage. Castor Troy, in the beginning of this film, within 30 seconds of the movie starting, goes to assassinate John Travolta's character and accidentally kills his 5-year-old son, who he's in proximity. That kind of kicks off the story. We fast forward 5 or 6 years. I think it's 6 years. Sean Archer, John Travolta's character, is kind of living a life in shambles. His marriage is pretty bad. His wife's played by Joan Allen, who is phenomenal in this film. And John Woo fought for that casting. And I think that is wonderful. He's got, you know, a teenage daughter who's rebelling, played by Dominique Swan, soon to be Lolita. and they finally catch Castor Troy, this terrorist, and he's in a coma. Except he's set up a bomb somewhere in Los Angeles, and they don't know where. They know the date it's going to explode. Castor Troy's very sort of imbecile younger brother is played by Alessandro Nivola, who I love. And they decide, they've put him in prison. They decide the only way to find out where the bomb is to go undercover and try to get Castor Troy's brother to tell them. The way to do this is to cut Castor Troy's face off. I'm going to use the term face off as often as possible.
Please do, yes.
So this is Nicolas Cage's face. Cut his face off, put it onto John Travolta's character's face, and have him go into the prison as a prisoner where no one actually knows this except for a few scientists, and get the information out of the brother character. What happens, unfortunately, is when you cut someone's face off and they're in a coma, it wakes them up. And so Nicolas Cage's character is like sat straight up, realized he doesn't have a face. But lo and behold, and I don't want to say it's on the nightstand, but basically it is, there's John Travolta's face. So he kidnaps the scientists and gets them to do the full surgery on him. So we have a full switcheroo, as I like to call it. And essentially, Nicolas Cage, the bad guy, kills anyone who knows that John Travolta has gone through this, and he's stuck as Castor Troy. But he has to save his family because John Travolta, who is really Nicolas Cage, is sleeping with his wife and like giving his daughter cigarettes and acting super strange at work, but no one seems to like clue in to what's happening.
These are people who also have completely different body types.
And they make a joke about we'll do some rhinoplasty. I can't remember if they say rhinoplasty. I think that's a nose job, but they're like, we'll just get those love handles off a little bit. And it's like, like John Travolta is a full 2 or 3 inches taller than Nicolas Cage, and there's no like wound healing. Like, I'm not saying I've had plastic surgery, but I've done the research. You're out for like, well, let's say I got a work done on my chin. That would probably be like 3 weeks.
I think they explained that somehow they have some kind of anti-inflammatory. They
sped up the healing process. Yeah. You're right, Rad. They do explain that. Yeah. But like electrolysis, like they have to change the body hair. They have to change hands. My whole thing is like hands. If my partner came home with some other guy's hands. Which right now I'm writing a screen. I should write a screenplay about this. I would know. I would know something was up. So I'd be like, those aren't your hands. Or even feet. Like, think about your partner's feet.
Your wedding ring doesn't fit. Like, that would be, I mean, I'm with you. That's actually really interesting. Okay. Like, again, I feel like this is something, it's fascinating to me because this movie was in development for so long. Yes. Like, people loved this script and it just kept getting from, like, iteration to iteration. At one point, it was, like, full scale in the future, like 2028, 2030, whatever. And then they were like, no, let's scale it back forward. And I'm fascinated that this is the version they landed on. But it does feel like it has more explanation and more world building in it than we actually need, given how incredible the action is.
Yeah.
Well, you know, like, speaking of, like, those previous iterations, and again, I don't know which of those previous iterations, like, are actually factual or people just telling, but I mean, because at one point, I think I read that at one point they considered this to be this futuristic movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone, which makes perfect sense. Like, that made absolute sense for that era. Like, of course you want to, if you're going to have two big action movie stars facing off, those are the two. One coming off of, like, you know, he's off of his Terminator fame, Stallone off of whatever the other fame, and set in the future, which is their jam often. And Stallone just had Demolition
Man. And Judge Dredd.
Right? And then I think even, like, one of their recent reunion movies, Escape Plan, does have them both in a futuristic prison having to escape, right? It almost looks like the Escape Plan is almost like, oh, we didn't get to make Face Off. Let's do this jailbreak movie here. So that totally makes sense. And I feel like what somehow coming down from that to make this movie is very weird. A lot of people must have been really, really upset. And yet it's a thing of beauty.
It's a ballet.
Right? It's like there's no way whatever the hell they were going to make the other version of what they were going to make was going to be anywhere near as good.
They also had to explain to a lot of executives exactly how this was going to work. Like, apparently one executive said that the makeup would have to be staggeringly good for people to believe these two had switched places. It's like, no, the actors just
he do thought he was going to do makeup.
That's how this works. And I think that's pretty amazing. I think the initial this is the perfect blend for me of, like, special effects and practical effects. Like, you kind of need special effects to be where they are to be able to pull this off. Because, like, even the bit where he's playing with the voice chip in his trachea and you kind of hear his voice kind of fuzzle and do things, I'm like, oh, that's kind of a neat idea of how you would approach that. Right? Like, how does the voice change?
Peach. I could eat
a peach for hours. Perfect.
This is a very thoughtful movie full of a lot of explosions.
I think, you know, I mean, John Woo is a phenomenal director, and I'm with you, Becky. Like, obviously, the John Woo film would be the ultimate action for me. But it's so important to just point out how committed Travolta and Cage were to this ridiculous plot. Like, they spent, I think it was like at least 3 weeks living together, or at least spending every day together to learn each other's mannerisms. And I have to say, John Travolta plays a better Nicolas Cage than sometimes Nicolas Cage is currently. It's amazing.
He still does the impersonation in interviews. People were like, can you give us a bit of Cage? And he'll do it. Like, apparently it is ingrained in him now.
You good looking. You're hot.
It's like looking in a mirror, only not.
It's really well done. And I just think this is a ridiculous plot. It's a ridiculous movie. I think it's almost an opera. I think it's masterful, same as you, Rad. But I just love that its actors never looked down on it. And I think that that's where Cage is at his greatest. And Travolta, too. I'm actually a very big John Travolta fan. And we just talked about John Travolta in Urban Cowboy on this podcast. And it's that any role they take, whether it's Battleship Earth or, you know, for Cage, there's obviously some phoned-in roles. I can't lie about that. That does happen. But when he is great and he's taking, you know, the story and he's twisting into something wonderful because he's committed. And that's why Mandy is so good. And that's why The Color Out of Space is one of the best Lovecraft adaptations we have, is because he's never, never looking down on the material. And they don't look down on this ridiculous film.
I agree, like, 100% that it is the performances that makes this go above and beyond. And it's like, I mean, I don't want to be dissing the action set pieces in this movie, but the real thrill in this movie is the violence in the domestic scenes, in the sense of, like, when John Travolta's getting off on the moves he's making on his on the other dude's wife.
Or the daughter, where, you know, that's the other one. Cassidy,
or the daughter, yeah. It's like these are like firework emotions that are happening in the scene of, I am lecturing lecturing this dude's daughter. I am making moves on this dude's wife. And when Nicolas Cage is on the other side of it, it's like where he's like kind of breaking under the reality of Caster Troy's world, like seeing that this guy has his son and this wife, like all the performances there are the most exciting things about.
And I think
this movie,
you know, coming back to Joan Allen, who producers, the studio were like, oh, you can't hire her. She's so old. She's 32 years old. She's not believable as a mother of a 16-year-old. Like, it was ridiculous. Like, they wanted someone super hot. Yeah. I mean, Joan Allen's like very hot to me anyway. But I think it really speaks to John Woo's integrity that he's like, no, this needs to be a believable wife. This needs to be someone who looks like a doctor, who looks like, you know, someone that has a marriage that's lasted 20 years and is grieving her son. And so it's very believable, those domestic pieces. And, you know, countering Joan Allen is, I think, a really fantastic performance from Gina Gershon.
I was just about to say that. Yeah. Like, if they've built these whole world of contrasts, and how do you contrast Joan Allen? Gina Gershon.
And she,
you know,
got cast
Showgirls
because
herself.
John Woo had seen her in Bound, which Bound is coming to Hollywood. So we are all very excited because Bound is fantastic. And so he really knew how to cast this film, and he knew how to fight for actresses. And I really respect that in him, because I don't think that was happening a lot in the action genre. And looking at Con Air, like, Monica Potter has nothing to do in that film. Literally nothing. It's fine. Like, there's not many roles for women. There's the female guard, who's quite good. But, like, this is actually a film that has fleshed out female characters. And that's really exciting.
Can we also talk that a lot of the character actor roles are filled with women, and like
Margaret Cho,
character actress Margaret Cho, CCH Pounder, two of my absolute favorites, who, you know, CCH Pounder gets horribly burned to a crisp with Canadian icon Colm Feore. I love Colm Feore so much. This was him. Apparently what he used to do, I love this, is my little Colm Feore thing, is that he got so much work because of 32 short films about Glenn Gould. Apparently this was like a darling, like it didn't do great in the box office, but he would like send it to directors he wanted to work with and be like, hey, if anyone is interested in this. And he apparently got a ton of American work based on this because people love that movie and they love him in it so much. And this is one of the movies he got this because of 32 short films about Glenn Gould. Think about that. Can you be burnt at the stake? Yes.
We might not have any good cop, Bond cop, if you didn't have to.
Please start with me on that. Bond cop, bad cop.
Sorry.
I've seen that
is
movie
it
way
Bond,
more times
is it Bond cop,
see.
Bad cop?
It's Bond cop, bad cop. Yes, it is.
I got
that
intoxicated
is
at like a party for, I want to say like Air Canada or something like that. And they had the grab bags were just like DVD copies of that film. And somehow I came home. It was like a joke between my partner and I because no one took them. And we have like 22 copies of that DVD. And I was like, I don't even know what to do with these. Like Valley Village. They're probably still out of Valley Village, all 22 copies of Good Cop, Bond Cop, Bad Cop, Bond Cop.
Bond Cop, Bad
Bond Cop.
Cop,
Bad
Bond
Cop, Cop.
That's
Bad
the
Cop,
one.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh my God. Now you're making me hate Facebook.
I like Colm Feore. Let me like Colm Feore. But I do really appreciate that they like your, and watching these 90s movies, you do get those moments of, oh, hey, it's so-and-so in an early role. And like, I think the 90s really are like the perfect time for that, guys, because there's just so many populated, like budgets were bigger, and they were making like putting more more opportunities out to make more films. So you have more opportunities for character actors who get to show up, and you're like, hey, you know, it's John Carroll Lynch. When's the last time I got to see John Carroll Lynch do something fun, right?
Throw Victor Garber on the Titanic, make him go down with the ship, and we're all also 97.
Yeah, I mean, like, look, we were talking about the emotional, the incredible performances, the emotional honesty versus the implausible setup here. But the action, I mean, can't dismiss how great the action is. And I think even in terms of, like, for John Woo, there's a certain elevation of his house style from Hard Boiled, because it's like, look, like, I mean, if you try to describe John Woo's action, like, you know, the double fisting hammers,
how many Mexican standoffs does one movie need? Like, there's four in here.
Yeah. Oh, the fact that a guy needs an entire clip of bullets before he finally goes down always, you know, like, I don't know if you remember in Hard Target where like Van Damme, I think he's like holding a gun upside down and like unloading an entire gun, and the guy's still standing, and then he kicks the cigar out of his mouth or something, or kicks his face so the cigar finally falls out, you know, like that kind of ludicrous action. But like John Woo's style of action is, I think, you know, again, it's so singular because I do feel like he's just extending the martial arts genre like into the gun violence genre, like into the Western, essentially, like basically like the gun action. It's all balletic dance action. That's like where like the guns are just extensions of these martial artists.
They're like
limbs,
ribbons, like a way, right? Rhythmic gymnastics routine. And except instead of exactly. ribbons, there's bullets and guns.
And then so seeing that in Face Off, I mean, like the my favorite, you know, you were asking earlier about favorite set piece. My favorite set piece is the action scene. It's immediately following the Over the mm-hmm. Rainbow business. It's that sequence where Travolta and Nicolas Cage turn around and face each other in the mirror, the mirror shot, right? Which is, by the way, it's a previous shot of John Woo's. He's done the back-to-back like standoff thing before where the two, and then, you know, it's there in Hard Target. But this one is like the one that really, it's like he perfected it in Face Off. It's like, I did this thing a bunch of times before, but I am perfecting it in this movie and making it work for what this
it really
story is.
Number one, he has the budget. And number two, he can bank on the fact that a lot of North Americans probably haven't seen his movies, right? At least the original versions, even with DVD releases.
Yeah, I mean, it really is the confluence and the like meeting of Hong Kong cinema and what made Hong Kong cinema such a, you know, blockbuster in the East and Hollywood. You would think that for a lot of actors coming from Hong Kong or from Asia in general, when they make their first Hollywood film, and certainly this isn't his first, he had Broken Arrow and Hard Target previous, it's usually a failure. I mean, think about Wong Kar-wai doing My Blueberry Nights, or, you know, that's maybe not the, well, no, that's an okay example because that was dismal. So most of the times that is what happens. And here we have John Woo. You know, and Hong Kong cinema is always riffing off of Hollywood and the films that they were seeing being imported in English-speaking theaters. And he understands Hollywood by being an outsider. And so in some ways, he's able to distill what's so exciting about Hollywood genre and Hollywood cliche and puts his own foreign spin on it. And it works perfectly. It's like, you know, a Russian conductor making some sort of like, this is not a good metaphor, a Russian conductor like working in a British ballet form. Like, it's just, there's something hybridity there that makes it both very familiar, but then uncanny. And this whole film is like Uncanny Valley, right? That's what it's playing off of. It's almost like a universal 1930s monster film. It's so uncanny. And I really, really appreciate this film. There's a speedboat chase. This is a film that has Nick Cassavetes, the son of John Cassavetes, and Jenna Rollins in it, playing the hammiest gangster who might have some sort of incestuous relationship with his sister. I'm unclear because there's that weird kiss. It's everything. It's everything that shouldn't be in a Hollywood film, but is there somehow and works.
That's the name. Just drop the mic. Don't forget the doves, though. Okay, no, right after you said that, the doves should have came flying through. The doves and the pigeons.
I should have grabbed someone's ass, because there's a lot of ass grabbing climax parts in this film. It's very unfortunate.
This too bad we're doing this on Zoom. Like, shit. Like, the ass cheeks would have been available.
All right. Okay. Well, then I think we should probably end it there. And Rad, once again, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I love it.
Now tell people how they can find you and your work, because you are everywhere.
I'm everywhere. So just start a Twitter and go from there. I'm at Just Say Rad on Twitter and Instagram, and you could find the rest of the shit out.
Excellent. Alicia Fletcher, thank you so much once again.
Thank you. I have two things. One, they wanted Jack Nicholson to play Castor Troy's father, and he would be, or sorry, mother, and he would be in drag. And I can't even imagine what that would be like if it happened.
This just gets weirder. Yeah.
And two, Rad and I are celebrating our 14-year friendship anniversary today.
According to Facebook.
There's like a good 6 months prior to that where we met. But
remember, it's also the birth of Facebook. So that was a whole, but yes.
I woke up to prepare for this podcast, and there was like 14, or like not 14, there's maybe like 12 photos of Rad and my history, like where like his child, who's now almost an adult, is like this tiny baby, and I look much thinner, and it was just all lovely. It was so lovely to see.
Yeah. I went through various weight fluctuations.
Various modes of hair and facial hair, too.
We have a very long history together, and I love it. I love that we're still actually able to work.
Thank you for that, Becky. It's really special for us.
It's always a pleasure. All right. And you can join us next week as we continue on with the cavalcade of absurd action films that were in 1997, as we're joined by podcaster and comedian Graham Clark, looking at Air Force One
and turbulence. That's coming up next week. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to email the podcast? You can do so at podcast@hollywoodsuite.ca. Want to chat with us and find more great content from Hollywood Suite? Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free. Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen on 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite On Demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cam Maitland, and featured Alicia Fletcher and Rad Simon Pillay as guests. Supervising producer is Emily Gagne. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant is Ryan Mains. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you next week.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.